Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 152 of the Big Rhetorical Podcast. If you're thinking that definitely is not Dr. Charles Woods, you would be completely correct. My name is Lena Larrero. I'm a fourth-year professional writing student at York University, and I've been an intern at the Big Rhetorical Podcast since January. Working with Dr. Woods has been an absolute pleasure. I'm new to podcasting, but getting to learn about the ins and outs of this extremely versatile and engaging medium has definitely left me with a profound appreciation for the genre, and I could not be more grateful for the opportunity. My task for the duration of my internship has been to produce this episode, an interview with a professor of mine I felt would contribute to the amazing conversations that have been had on TBRP. And I knew right away that professor had to be Dr. Brandi Easter.
So starting with that, what's a thing you can't know? Seeing where traditional research helps, and seeing for us, I think when we're working on our project, seeing where traditional argumentation doesn't work. And then sort of saying, okay, well, what else can I do? What else can I try here?
Dr. Brandi Easter is an assistant professor in the writing department at York University. Her research and teaching focus on digital rhetoric, feminist rhetoric, and software studies. And her work has appeared in Rhetoric Review and Feminist Media Studies. In 2020, she received the Rhetoric Society of America Dissertation Award, and her upcoming book, Visual Rhetoric, co-authored by Dr. Krista J. Olson, won the University of Michigan Press and Sweetland Publication Prize in Digital Rhetoric in 2022. In our conversation for this episode, I asked Dr. Easter to talk about how she has challenged her students to see past traditional ways of thinking and engaging with digital rhetoric, and the kinds of experimental projects, including one of my own from last year, that have come out of it. I cannot wait to introduce you to her. So without further ado, let's begin.
Dr. E, I'm sure as somebody who's listened to this podcast before, you know the first question you're going to get, but who are you? What's your name, your institutional affiliation, your title and role there? Who are you and what do you do?
Easy question, right? So I am Brandi Easter. I am an assistant professor in the writing department at York University. My research and teaching are all around digital media, and I'm really fortunate to get to work with folks like you in sort of our third year, fourth year digital writing track. So that's a cool thing about it. It's a small program, but we also have a digital focus within it. That's what I do.
Yeah, because you've been my professor for digital writer, like digital authorship, and also for coding for professional writers. So you kind of have like a wider scope than just traditional writing.
Yeah, and I think that's a really cool thing about our program is getting the opportunity to teach stuff like that. So not just having the digital track, but, you know, I propose a writing and coding class and everyone's on board. Yeah. So I think really an expansive idea of what writing is something that our department does well.
For sure, yeah. It gives us lots of different opportunities to try different things within writing. So we've talked about this before one-on-one, and you mentioned that you weren't initially in rhetoric studies when you were taking your BA. What were you doing before?
Well, I wasn't in rhetoric studies in my BA, and I wasn't in rhetoric studies in my MA, and I wasn't in rhetoric studies in my PhD. So I made a series of choices. The short answer is it's Jim Brown's fault. As a grad student in English literary studies, I got the opportunity to work with Jim Brown. I was already interested in technology and what you could do with it, but from a literary studies perspective, it was much more, how can I use, you know, the tools of computation to learn something else, right? Like, can I put all the 19th century novels I can find into make a corpus out of them and do sentiment analysis. And when I got the opportunity to work with Jim, I realized, oh no, I can ask questions about the technology itself. And that's a really interesting place to be. So I got fully sucked over into rhetoric, happily realized I was probably already doing that anyway, but it took me a while to find and to know. So I switched mid-PhD from literary studies to composition and rhetoric. It's not a route I recommend, but it worked.
And did you know you wanted to be a professor when you were switching? Was it something that was already on your mind?
I think I've always thought there are lots of things I could do that would make me happy. So at sort of every juncture, so when I left my BA, I applied to like MAs, and I also applied to graphic design. So I was always sort of thinking, these are the like bucket of things I'm interested in. What can I do with them? I think by the time I was in my PhD, part of what drew me to rhetoric was that I really loved teaching. And so like the opportunity that to think of teaching as a scholarly activity and that it is not a thing maybe you do on the side in addition to research, that's the thing that also drew me to rhetoric. So I knew I loved teaching, and I was maybe hopeful about getting to do this. But yeah, I think with academia, you just don't know. So you just toss all the cards out and see what happens. But yeah, I love teaching.
I certainly love your teaching style. So it's been, you've been my teacher, I mentioned, for two classes now, and we work on the side together. And I've taken, I think, any class I can take with you, because
Think you're maxed out.
I maxed out. Yeah, unfortunately. We're kind of disappointed. I couldn't take any more classes with you this semester. But part of why I wanted to invite you onto the podcast today was to talk about the ways you make your classes so engaging, because what I found is, as your student, is that it's never just traditional projects. You kind of go out of the box and you challenge us to think differently and do different things. And I have one project in mind, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. But I wanted to talk first about something you did a couple of years back, which is toward a feminist pedagogy. And you mentioned, like, I know that's a class that you probably. It was a study for a class you did quite a while back, but it caught my eye when I was kind of preparing for this interview because, I was looking for kind of strands, something to connect our topics together, and it felt like a good starting point. So I kind of wanted to talk a bit about that one. And you mentioned that this course, the one that you were teaching right there, was the first one where you kind of had the opportunity to break away from the standardized curriculum and shape the course as you wished. So talk a bit about the experience behind that. How did that feel, and where were you kind of hoping to take it?
Oh, it was terrifying and exciting. So I have to thank the folks at UW-Madison who sort of support the first year, second year writing, how much sort of guidance and support we have. And then also in this second year intermediate level, the opportunity to really think like capaciously and broadly about what it was we valued and wanted to do. So this is the first class where I felt like I'm really getting to try some things, learn a lot, and see what I could do. I think, yeah, you asked, we don't do a lot of traditional things. And part of that is that I'm interested in digital media. And the other part of it is that I get bored. I very much struggle to teach the same class too often. I'm always wanting to try something new, and adjust things. And my life would be a lot easier if I would stop doing that. But I am a curious person. So those are some of the things I was thinking about was how do I take these goals of this intermediate writing class, which had a particular audience for it in that they were largely non-majors. So it was a large gen ed requirement. And most of the people who were English majors weren't going to pick this one. So I knew part of what I was really interested in was how do I convince my students that what we're doing matters? So you have only had classes with me in which you're sharing a room with lots of other writing people. Like you all come on board thinking writing is interesting. And in this class, I was really thinking, how do I reach these students who are in business and engineering and just need this gen ed requirement and help them connect up what we're doing with something they might care about. So I think that was really the foundation of starting what I wanted to do in this class, was how do I take these goals about communication, for a non, like mostly non-writing audience and maybe people who don't want to be there, or it's not their favorite class, and do it in a way that I could engage them. And so podcasting, well, sound writing was a really nice way to go, I think, because it had both sort of textual components, right? Like we could write scripts, we could think about language in some of those ways, but then we could also move it into this other space. So instead of doing something more more multimodal, you know, like a game or something with a lot of visual components, I felt like the Sonic let me kind of get the best of both. Like it let us think about textual writing and communication, and it also let us push on that a little bit.
How did you find your students reacted to this kind of shift in project styles? Like, was it what they were expecting? Was it a little bit new for them?
Yeah, so I think that because the group of students who take this class are often non-majors, I think they kind of don't know what to expect, right? Like, think about your gen eds. You pick a class in another department and it's a dice roll, right? Yeah. Like, I'm not really sure what to expect here. So I think a lot of them don't know what to expect. And I do think they are often surprised to be not writing essays exclusively. And sometimes that's a positive surprise, and sometimes it's a challenging surprise, especially whenever you're also introducing like technology that they need to use. But I think it's a really positive challenge that, for me, whenever you move out of the textual only writing, you get the opportunity to make things about textual writing visible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're surprised usually. And some of them are happy because a lot of them are not, they don't want to write essays. Yeah. If they did, they would be English majors.
And then how do you think this experience kind of like influenced your teaching style?
So I was looking back over this today, and I first have to thank my collaborator, Meg Marquardt at Mississippi State. Meg does amazing research in rhetorics of science. And so bringing Meg into working on this was really, really helpful for thinking about like ways of knowing. What was your question?
How do you think this influenced your teaching style?
Oh, okay. So I was reading this today and I was like, I would really love to ask Selena what Selena sees here, because I actually read through this and I thought, this is actually what I'm still doing. Just in a little bit of a different way. So I was curious, actually, did you see anything in here that like sounded or felt like that's kind of what we did? Not to put you on the spot, but I was curious because I'll talk through what I saw.
No, that's a fair question. I think for me, I saw that you were kind of chasing it, not a theory, but some kind of concept that you thought would be worth experiencing for us. Like the project that we did together, it was very much like, I found this reading and I think it's really cool. And I think it's really worthwhile for you guys to experiment with. And it'll teach you to interact with digital writing in like a new way. So here you go, try it out. And I saw that kind of that mentality in sound writing when I read it the first time.
I totally agree, right? Like that sort of model of, I really think of most of the things we do in our classes as being experiments. That sort of just try something. Mm-hmm. It might not work. Give it a shot. And sort of structuring ways to do that and it be okay. I was really thinking about that. And I was also thinking about this sort of way that I'm in this sort of ways of knowing sequence. So starting with the prompt for this assignment being, what is a thing you can't Google the answer to?
Yeah.
So just sort of starting with that, you would be amazed at the interesting things people come up with. One of my favorites was, who left the sweatshirt in our house at the party last weekend? Right. So just something that simple, but what is a thing you can't Google? And I see a lot of connections to the things that we were working on in our digital class around like, well, what are the things I can't just fact check? Or what are the things that fact checking doesn't help me deal with? Right. So then what are the other ways I can move through this? So starting with that, what's a thing you can't know? Seeing where traditional research helps, and seeing for us, I think when we're working on our project, seeing where traditional argumentation doesn't work. And then sort of saying, okay, well, what else can I do? What else can I try here? I think was really a connection that I saw. And this is still very much something that I hope we do. Is like, when we're doing research, what does that mean? And how does the way in which we do that research shape the answers we come to and even the questions we can ask, which I think is a very feminist pedagogy, to sort of see how the methods that you're working in, the frames that are leading you to ask those questions are already shaping what you might notice and see. Looking back on this, I really like this class, and I really see how our class together was sort of a different version of this.
It felt like a next level, but you were working with writing students this time. So you could get us interested in writing in a new way too.
Yeah. So, I mean, working with you all as writing students and also in the third year, right? So we could do something, we could do more theoretical readings. You had taken a rhetoric class, right, in your second year. So you were a little bit more ready to jump into that. But definitely that idea of like the experiment and iteration and trying things I see as being still really central. I was thinking when I read it, I was like, I wonder what Selena thought.
So I guess because we're already on the topic, I'm pivoting a bit and I want to talk about the class that we're specifically talking about right now. So for all our listeners, I'm talking about intermediate digital authoring or professional writing 3001, because I'm sure we're going to say 3001 at some point in this conversation. And I wanted to kind of ask for some insights. You talked a bit about like kind of that pattern that you followed and you've brought it into this new class, but the specific topics that we spoke about, things like AI and just digital writing in general and the kind of issues we face as digital authors, what drew you to these topics and then what made them especially relevant to you?
Yeah. Okay. So we probably did this all out of order talking about
That's fine.
our other projects. So we got to work together in 3001 and the frame of this course. So you're now in 4001. The idea of 3001 is that it's your theoretical grounding in digital writing so that you can move into this fourth level, not just with sort of technical skills, right? But those like rhetorical, ethical, social, cultural awarenesses that digital writers need. So when I'm thinking about, and this is one of the, I think, hardest things about teaching a digital writing class is it's always challenging to strike that balance between teaching technology specifically and teaching ways to think about technology, right? So I'm sure you've been in other versions of digital courses where the focus is on proficiency in a particular software, right? And that's very valuable. But in this course, my goal is much closer to helping you develop strategies for using particular software, sure, but also choosing which ones you're going to use and figuring out how to navigate them and to interpret what's on them. So when I'm thinking about what I really value and what I hope it is that folks walk away from a, third year foundational theory class, I think it really comes back to developing strategies to hold, notice, and work through complexity. So if digital writing is anything, it is complex.
Yes. And
quickly changing, right? So part of the complexity is the speed and the scale of it. But I think part of the complexity that we focused the most on was it's a lot of unknowability and ambiguity and how open-ended, right, a lot of the problems are. So that is really the main goal that I focus on and try to balance with all of the goals in sort of the class is really how can I help you develop strategies, ways of noticing complexity, trying to appreciate that complexity and developing like thoughtful, nuanced responses to it. And I think that's one of the most important things, especially like you said, if you think in any given year, if you think about whatever the hot button digital writing issue is, it has to deal with complexity, right? So AI, which you mentioned, but also, in the time I've been teaching, fake news, misinformation, the proliferation, the spread, the speed, communities, identities, right? Like everything that people think about that we talk about too in our sort of more popular discourse.
Yeah.
We need ways to grapple with that. And so that's, I am biased, but I think rhetoric is a particularly good way to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of, it's a sneaky rhetoric class.
The sneaky rhetoric class.
It's a sneaky rhetoric class.
It's like sneaky in a good way, though. I think it's definitely worthwhile because, I mean, and something we spoke about and something we based our major project off of was this idea of a wicked problem, and that like a lot of these issues that we see online, it's just a lot of back and forth of like, I agree with this, so this is stronger, or you agree with this, so like you agree with this, I don't agree with that. That kind of thing, evaluating facts over kind of trying to come to any kind of understanding. So it's not an easy, it is very nuanced, like that nuance. That's something I really got out of our class, I think, that ability to see nuance and then also to accept it, you know, like to not just to be like, okay, this person has a different understanding than I do, but also to kind of be like, how can I talk about this in a constructive way without kind of just completely disregarding what they're saying? Because the second you disregard it is the second it becomes like a fight rather than a conversation. And it's easy to fall into those pitfalls in social media and other kinds of discourse.
For sure. And I think that has been one of the goals that have really developed out for me and what I think is important in digital writing. So if I think about when I was teaching, you know, this podcasting class or sort of at that time, a lot of the urgency was we need to teach students how to fact check, how to know what a reliable source is, right? How to compare different information and figure out which one is correct. And both my colleague Meg, who wrote this with me, and I have thought about this. Meg actually, because her experiences in science, wrote a really great blog post for the Sweetland DRC about sort of a lesson plan for how do you deal with really absurd fake science? How do you sort of pick it apart and identify it? And I think what I want to do with Wicked Problems is point to how identifying it isn't enough, mm-hmm. right? That idea that we can identify what's real and what's fake and demarcate it doesn't really change the deliberative impasse that we're in, right? Mm-hmm. It's all still there. Mm-hmm. And so if fact-checking is not what we need, if that's not what digital literacy is, mm-hmm. Then what? And I think Wicked Problems is one of those things that helps me get there. So if I'm thinking, what are ways I can look at a problem and not solve it, but even just try to identify what the problem is. Mm-hmm. That's why I like to do the Wicked Problems frame. So Wicked Problems is like a 1970s policy idea, which is interesting because the whole concept of it is what you do in a lab is not what you can do in the world, right? Mm-hmm. Like we don't have the kinds of controls that you have in a lab. And sort of responding to say social problems need different solutions mm-hmm. and different ways of looking at them. And it's really sort of a user experience, UX, UI kind of approach. But it gives us 10 ways to sort of say, how might this problem be really complicated? And mm-hmm. I like the provocativeness of wicked problems in that wicked might mean like bad or evil, but that's not actually the intention. It's really just complexity. But yeah, so how can we look at problems and see how they might be complex? I don't know if I answered your question.
I think you did.
I got excited.
But actually on the topic of this kind of that name, that's like, it seems like it's going to be evil, but it's not. I want to talk about the Demon Archive project.
For all our listeners, this was our final project in PRWR 3001. It's based on an experimental writing practice coined by Jenny Rice in her book, Awful Archives, Conspiracy, Theory, Rhetoric, and Acts of Evidence. In the book, Rice introduces the practice as a way to counter dead-end discourse, the kinds of arguments that have each participant claiming their evidence outweighs each other's, pitting the conversants against each other instead of allowing for productive conversation. Now, it's not easy to define a demon archive, but in my experience as someone who has written one, the simplest way to describe it is as a kind of collection of artifacts, a written archive of events, ideas, concepts that exist, have existed, were erased, or never existed in the first place in public discourse, that inform one another, but that don't particularly draw a conclusion. It's laced with the author's understanding of the topic at hand and seeks to learn what those artifacts can tell us about an event, problem, or situation rather than simply deeming them valid or invalid evidence. Dr. Easter also had us experiment with the form we presented our projects in. For my project, I created a Google site to look like a sort of Reddit forum on the dark web.
I'd love to describe Selena's project for our listeners if I could. So it's called the Docs Files, and I've pulled it up right now. It's a website made in Google Sites. Please feel free to correct me or add on to here. The art is very inspired by Jenny Rice's book cover. So this Lovecraftian octopus horror. And if you scroll down, I see I have a logo for something called the Docs Files. It's a really spooky skull with sort of it's a glitchy skull. And it looks like I've searched the subreddit for the Docs Files. So I'm looking at my results and it starts with a comment from the author. And it says, "It's worse than I thought," which is strange considering the first time I heard about it, someone had died. The project continues in this sort of conversation between a user and the author to sort of take this problem of like, well, we know doxing is bad, that people are really being harmed. Why is it happening? So as you move through the website, you've got this feel of, I think, that experience of going down a Reddit rabbit hole and maybe venturing off into some other places. It's very dark. There's lots of links. It walks me through thinking through this. And I think one of the most interesting things you did in this was, you know, you started with this problem that you knew about and then thought about it sort of on the other end to say, well, what about when doxing is being used to combat other forms of harm, right? Like, what if there are like benefits to that? Or if it's just, it's not so easy to say it's like good and bad, right? So looking at particular cases where, well, that person was causing harm. Do I agree with it? No, I don't know.
But we'll talk more on that later. Now, let's get back to the podcast.
So how did you find out about the Demon Archive and what did you find compelling about it?
Yeah. Okay. So many things. So I obviously love this book. And what I love about it is that it is addressing exactly these, even though, you know, the project, Rice's project is not about digitality. Everything, all of the issues that come up around these sort of cases and conspiracy theories to me are so inextricably digital, or they're magnified in digital context. So I think it gives us like a really useful lens in. But so the goal of this class and something that I think is connected to the podcasting assignment is I want us to really rethink what we think research is. And in particular, for the reasons you just said, right? Like in an academic context, here is my job. And I like to ask students to do this. So I did a couple weeks ago. I said, what's your research process? Like you're doing something, what's your research process? Okay, well, pick a topic, decide what I think about it, write my argument, and then go find sources, right? And there's a reason that we do that, not just because we're like practicing arguments a valuable thing to do, but it's some of the realities of an academic timeline is that, you know, you have this many number of weeks and you have to turn something in and we have to get through this and it has to be evaluated, right? Like you don't have time to decide what you think about it really, because you're going to get rated. So you need to pick an argument and stay with it. So lots of reasons why we do that. And so what I like about this class is having the chance to unpack that. So we do that first chunk. So reading in digital scholarship, what are the issues in digital scholarship? Moving into wicked problems, how do we apply them? And then that last being a demon archive. So I have often said jokingly that my teaching philosophy is stealing. and that is very true here in that I did not create Demon Archives. It's entirely Jenny Rice's concept. So what is a writing practice that we can do if we're setting aside that goal of fact checking, right? Like you could certainly imagine. So the project that you worked on, you could certainly imagine fact checking that.
Yeah.
you could do a version of that project where you show what's real, show what's not, and say what's correct and what's not. Wouldn't change it.
No.
It would still be Kiwi Farms.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the things I like about the frame that Rice offers in Demon Archives, because like you said, it connects to, it's provocative in that idea of the wicked problems and the Demon Archives, sort of, I think, asking us to take on challenging things, right? I think both the frame of wickedness and demonness gives us permission, I hope, to look at something challenging, right? And to be challenged and to be befuddled by it and for it to be complex and frustrating. And so the frame for a Demon Archive from Rice is pretty open. The frame for me is pretty open, right? But it all sort of revolves around that question of not what is this evidence of, but what does it do? And so Rice does a version of that on Pizzagate. It's really textual. This is for a digital class. We have a web version of that. And so there's that double challenge that I think you met really well and can talk about, which is researching and trying to understand a complex digital phenomenon. And then also thinking, how do I use the affordances of a digital space to explain that phenomenon and sort of what I've noticed? So yeah, that's what we do. And I think a lot of, well, I don't know. I think there's something about it that is, so around week like 7 or 8 of the course, I always say we're in trust me mode.
I remember like, that.
Like week 7 or 8, everyone is very uncomfortable because it's hard to conceptualize having a solution very soon. And so having to sort of just wrap your head around like, what is this project she's asking us to do? And why are there demons involved?
And what is a demon archive?
And what is a demon archive? And I will say we, you know, really use Rice's book as sort of like foundation for that. But because it is proposed as such like a creative, generative approach, it's not super easy to define either. So I've been learning from all of you in how you're sort of shaping and defining it for yourself. Even, but
even when I was like preparing for this interview, I was like writing in some sort of, I was writing a definition of a demon archive. And I went back to my project and I tried to pull from there, but I'm like, this is just, there's so much context lacking here. Like, I feel like it's a good concept. It's a good practice. It's definitely experimental, but it is difficult to grasp. And it's actually something I did want to talk to you about, that kind of like friction between the students and like that trust me mode that you kind of have to fall into. Like, what do you talk a bit about their reactions to it? Cause I mean, I'm on the other end as a student, and we just basically had to, we read it and we all just kind of came to class the next day and we're like, what's going on here? Did you understand this? But it ended up working out, I think, for the most part. So tell me a bit about that as a teacher. How did you experience
I can tell that? You a bit about that. And I would love for you to tell me a little bit about that. So I'm teaching this class again right now. And one of the things that we did in the last class was, I was asking, okay, we did sections of the book in this order. This one made more sense to you. Do you think I should flip it next time? So I think that's part of how I navigate it, is I'm trying to be really responsive. But I also think, there's a couple of things. So I really do think there is value in taking on something really challenging, like Jenny Rice's work. I've always been super impressed by how people take it up. I would say my strategies for that, for making that doable, right? Because it doesn't feel good to read something and not understand it, or to feel like I'm going to be tested on this and I can't repeat it. So one of that is talking about what it means to read scholarship, right? So especially if usually, I don't know, my experience as an undergrad, if I read scholarship, it was sort of like one article, or it was the article or book that I found when I'd already decided what my thesis was, and it proved my point and agreed with me. So that experience of sort of sitting with an entire scholarly monograph, it's a different kind of reading. So part of it is that framing, right? So what are we looking for when we're reading a theoretical piece? And it's not the same as reading a textbook, right? We're getting lenses to think with. And I think one of the best things about a good theoretical piece is something different stands out to you every time, right? So I encourage students to sort of follow the ways that it's matching up for them. The other thing is that we work on connecting it to specific examples, right? Mm-hmm. So taking that case study and wicked problems approach. So it may seem really abstract to talk about evidence in this way, but what if we move it down to a real example? Mm-hmm. How does that sort of play out? And the other thing I'd say that's really important as a teacher is thinking about assessment practices. Mm-hmm. So if it's all great to say, I want to encourage risk taking. Mm-hmm. However, that does not change the stakes for you as a student, right? Mm-hmm. If points are on the line, and your grade and, you know, the things you want to do are on the line, that's a real detriment to the capacity to take risk. So part of that is also in how I have adapted assessment practices, right? So I give a lot of value to the in-class work that we do, to reflecting on the kinds of experiments you take, to those reading notes you take every week, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's my way of communicating. I value the trying. And I don't know, I would love to hear what your journey through it was. And sort of, because I'm asking my current students this too, like where do you move from uncomfortable to sort of like feeling like you've got a handle on something? What was it like to just have like contemporary rhetorical theory thrown to you?
It was, I don't know. I feel like I think I ended up liking this reading more than I initially, or understanding it more than I initially expected. Because when I was looking, when I started researching for the Demon Archive, for my Demon Archive, which I did about, for our listeners, I did a piece on doxing. And kind of where it's come from and what it's doing and why people use it so often. It didn't really click for me until we had someone come and talk to us about it. Come and talk to us about that idea of like, okay, you don't need to answer this question and you don't need to kind of be in support of this thing that you find really detrimental to society. But all you have to kind of ask is like, okay, what is it doing and how is it doing it? Like, what is the effect of it? And as soon as that clicked for me, I kind of felt very free and free in a way that I don't usually feel in a lot of other academic essays when you're trying to answer a question, when you're trying to make a thesis, because it let me just kind of fall into this rabbit hole of information and of pop culture and just like online activity and really just try and work out, okay, where did this thing come from? Why do people like it so much? And just answering those two questions gave me plenty of even more content than I could even put in my 2000 word essay. But it was kind of like, it really did click when I realized it doesn't have to be that I wasn't writing the same thing that I'd been writing before. I could do whatever the heck I wanted with it, you know? And I think that's the beauty of having something like this experiment, which is really what it is, because you can experiment however you want. And that's what I did.
You did, to great success. And I should say that person who visited us to help us think about how do we move forward was Meg.
Was it? Okay, I thought it might be, but yeah, I wasn't 100% sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Meg was talking about her research, right, on science and sort of creationist science, right? Mm-hmm. So looking at how are these claims made, I can certainly disprove them. Mm-hmm. But what is it doing, right? Yeah. Like, why, how is this working rhetorically? What kinds of argument is this making? Mm-hmm. I think her work is a great model of that. And I would say what I'm doing now is, because I have amazing work from folks like you, is I'm having you all come back and be able to give a survivor's testimony, right? To be able to say like, no, it's really okay. Like, go down a rabbit hole. And I mean, my main goal in that is you pursue something that is urgent and interesting and important to you. Mm-hmm. I think teaching a digital class, if I pre-selected topics, by the time we got there to work on those topics, they might not be the most pressing topics anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, I try as much as possible to say like, no, what are you seeing? What are you noticing? What are the online spaces you're in? What are the problems you're facing? Mm-hmm. So that you can sort of dig into those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People did all kinds of things with it. I know there was one about parasocial relationships and like fan fiction. And I think my friend did hers on typography and kind of the kinds of detrimental ways it's being used off of one of our readings we had. It wasn't easy, but how did you find that kind of perception of the project changed as people, like I've spoken about my experience, but like as a whole for the class, how did you find that kind of perception switched?
I feel like definitely having someone else say that this is okay is helpful, right? Because it's one thing to hear from me when you're also as a student trying to guess, what does this person want?
Mm-hmm.
Like whenever you're writing assignment, whoever your audience yeah. is also my teacher.
Yes.
So I think that that's helpful to sort of have that extra frame. And I would say for some folks, I think it doesn't happen until the project's over. Like I think this is the point of Demon Archives is to, and writing is not to know what you're doing beforehand, but to use it as a way of thinking. So yeah. I think that for a lot of folks, even at the end, that's when you reach the point where you're like, oh, I know what I'm doing. And mm-hmm. that was sort of your experience too, right? Because we came to yours to revise it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, and that's one of my goals, is not necessarily that everyone leaves with this project that is, you know, ready to put on their portfolio, but that they've gotten this little seed for themselves and mm-hmm. taken one sort of chart through it. So it might be something they can come back to. And yeah, I think your colleague is going to come back to that typeface project.
She is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like collecting stuff for my own Demon Archive, honestly. Like I've started saving screenshots and stuff like that to use for my own thing. So,
and that's part of what like I hope for as well, right? That just that active noticing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So now you have a different attunement now. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing certain things related to doxing and you're just sort of like snipping them for yourself. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think research really is. It's,
yeah.
it's noticing and developing that sort of capacity and mindset. But yeah, I would say the finished projects for the Demon Archive are often unfinished. And yeah. that's okay because. Mm-hmm. writing them is the generative part.
And that's part of it too, I think, as well. And I think Jenny Rice says that in her book that like at your genius, the kind of self you put into it, the demon part of it, which I don't think I can accurately describe to our listeners, but the kind of frame that you end up putting into this work, depending on kind of how you've seen it and how you've been understanding it as you've done your research, it can change. And it's free to change, and it's going to change because these issues are so complex, and you're going to change in how you perceive it. Like even I think there's so much more I could do with my Docs Files project. Like there are so many more things I could add, and I almost feel like I'm doing a disservice to the project by just kind of keeping it as it is. But I also value the fact that it's done now. You know,
it's like, done. Yeah,
it's done now. Mm-hmm. And I can come back to it and I can do something else.
Are you going to share sort of more about your project, either like with me or just with listeners, sort of like what your process was that you went through? Because it's an excellent project.
We can talk about it here. I think Charles and I might.
So what's the wicked mm-hmm. problem you started with?
My wicked problem when I started was this kind of, I wasn't really sure where I wanted to take it because there was a couple different topics I was interested in, doxing and swatting and then cyber stalking. So this idea of like people using information as a weapon, and using it to their own advantage. And the time I was really interested in the fact that like streamers that I was somewhat aware of in the community, in the gaming community, were being swatted and had SWAT teams sent to their house by random people on the internet because they just wanted to punish them for existing, for just playing games for the most part, or just to get attention. And I didn't, I mean, like, that's awful. obviously. Somebody has died because of this. Other people have gotten PTSD because of it. It was a serious issue that I saw. But what could I say about it, you know, other than just that? So I started diving deeper, and it became obvious to me that this was like that finding that their location, their house, and their address, and releasing that publicly so other people could do that. That was a more foundational issue, something I could talk about a bit more. And I just wanted to know why people wanted to do it. Like, where did it come from? Why are people doing this? Why is it so effective? Because it is effective. And then what laws are in place to combat it, if any, which there kind of aren't. So falling into that rabbit hole and just learning more and more about where it's come from and what people have done with it for the past like 30 years or so, because this is a longstanding concept. It was a good one. It was just something I was happy to learn more about.
Yeah. And so you started with that wicked problem of, you know, like very real harm coming mm-hmm. to people because of the way information is used online, and all of those topics are related, right? The cyberstalking, the doxing, all of that. And I think you started to identify, right? Like, okay, this is really complex. There's mm-hmm. a legal dimension to it. Mm-hmm. There are personal dimensions to it. There's particular platforms I see it happening on. Certainly you started with a problem that had very clear consequences. Mm-hmm. And one that I think if you start thinking through solutions is very difficult to do, right? And so then how did you sort of decide? So here's my area of interest. Mm-hmm. Here are the like complexities I see within it. How did you sort of then get rooted into the route you took it? So Kiwi Fox, like how did you get there? Because I think you did a good job of saying like, well, here's some streamers I've seen. Here's some very real cases. Mm-hmm. How did you sort of find the like line you would take?
I came across the story of Chris Chan. And that was kind of the first person that was targeted on this forum called Kiwi Farms. And it like... For me, that was it. I was like, okay, the most well-documented person on the internet, not a good person by any means, but if we're going to talk about like consequences, real consequences that have come out of technology, or just like acting, doing things online, they were a good place to start for mm-hmm. me. And then I just kind of fell deeper into Kiwi Farms and understanding what that was from. And then I fell even deeper into understanding that whole thing with Cloudflare and like when them dropping them as a, what's it called? Dropping Kiwi Farms as a client, because the real life harm that the people on Kiwi Farm were doing was getting so out of hand. And I was like, okay, this is exactly what we're talking about in the class. Like, this is exactly what we wanted to talk, what we were targeting. We were talking about, we were studying like Mar Hicks and my computer's on fire and, or your computer's on fire and all these other kinds of amazing.
All of our computers are on fire.
All of our computers are on fire. And, to me, it just kind of kept falling. And once I hit the bottom and I was looking back up, I was like, okay, there's only so much I could talk about in this, and Cloudflare and Kiwi Farms are just like a good place to start.
Yeah. And I think the way you sort of described this research process of like expansion mm-hmm. and narrowing, right?
Yeah.
Is really what I would hope for. Cause that's what research is. Like, you find new questions when you find some answers. Mm-hmm. And I think the place you landed, right? Like, it's not a tech problem. Mm-hmm. It's not a tech problem. It's a people problem.
Yeah.
I think was a really nice place to land with such a complex issue. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to share a little about how the project looks and feels, because it does so nicely capture, I think, that the disorienting experience of finding all the ways your computer's on fire and then trying to find some water. Right. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make sure to share a little of that because it's a fantastic project.
Thank you very much. Those are all the questions I have for you today, Dr. E. Thank you very much for having this conversation with me and for just, it's been a good time. Hope you've enjoyed it.
Of course. I hope we weren't too confusing because you're my research assistant. So we talk regularly. So
this
I hope
isn't the first time
this into a narrative this. Somehow that makes sense to other people.
I think we should be able to. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, great. But yeah, thanks so much for having me.
No problem. It's great to have you.
that's all I have for you all today, folks. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Big Rhetorical Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, but more than anything, I hope you've enjoyed getting to know one of my absolute favorite professors and the amazing work she's doing with her classes and digital rhetoric. If you'd like to get in touch with her, you can find Dr. E on X, the app formerly known as Twitter, at Brandi Easter, spelled B-R-A-N-D-E-E-E-A-S-T-E-R, and on her website, BrandiEaster.com. If you'd like to know more about me, well, that episode's coming soon. Until then, as Charles says, always be listening, rhetorically.
The Big Rhetorical Podcast is produced by Exalt Digital Media. Exalt Digital Media, not for profit. The Big Rhetorical Podcast was recorded on the land of many Native nations, past and present. These original homelands are territories of indigenous peoples who are largely dispossessed and removed. We specifically acknowledge the traditional stewardship of this land by the Wichita, Kickapoo, and Tawakoni peoples. Music for the Big Rhetorical Podcast is brought to you by DJ Lane, Stepha Helix, and Airtones.